Okay, we had a couple of questions left over.
Could you go back to the previous diagram we were discussing before the break?
Yeah. You mean the one that Gordon
brought up? The unresolved issues, et cetera. Yeah, thanks. I believe you were speaking to us in terms of helping us getting beyond unresolved issues in our own life. My question has to do with when we see two people that we love very much who are stuck in an unresolved situation, and either because of inaction or misunderstood actions, this perpetuates itself for years. As compassionate people, what is our responsibility to try to intervene and move them forward?
Okay, that's a very good question. She's saying sometimes the what's unresolved is like between two family members, let's say. Like you have brother and sister who don't talk to each other, or you're a couple that you know is not talking to each other. And all you can do is be present supportively, not take sides, and keep them in your loving kindness practice, and continually offer the option of working something out. But you can't convince them or force them if they're not ready for it. Some people just want to keep something unresolved. They have become possessed by the unresolved. And it's hard to break into that.
When we use all these terms of good and evil and bad and good and so forth, lately Richard Rohr has been using the term both/and.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you could help me with that. I struggle with just exactly where he's going with that.
That he's saying both and instead of either or. So all of us have sometimes gone toward the dark and sometimes gone toward the light. Possession means that you are stuck in, usually in the dark, but sometimes you could be animated by the good, and then it's not called possession, it's called a calling that you're totally focusing on. But all of us have both sides in us. Yeah, hi.
Real quick, last night I went on Facebook, which I hardly ever go on, and I noticed there is, well, everybody's talking, blah, 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 that there was a cartoon on there, and it was a park bench, and there was a young man sitting there, and then Jesus was on the other side of the park bench. So they were talking back and forth, and the young man is saying, well, I don't understand why there's hunger. I don't understand why there's so much suffering. I don't know why, you know, we live in such an awful world. And Jesus just looked at him. He says, well, that's funny. I was going to ask you the same question.
Thank you. That summarizes it very well. I also wanted to point out one of the reasons I really love doing this here at Word and Life. For instance, this page here, in which we talked about, you know, what's unresolved. I was responding to what Gordon brought up. And what upholds it, what undermines it, how it shows us what our view of God is, and so forth. This all just came to me as I was pondering it and opening it up. And I feel that happens a lot here. Sometimes I'm saying what I already knew when I came in. But about half the time, it's what you bring up that opens up something in me, and then something comes through. I consider it a grace. And so, you know, being here has many graces in it for me. So I thank you for that. Thank you. Now, before I go on to the other, I had a poem by Emily Dickinson that I wanted to share. It's fairly simple to understand, and it will... It kind of responds to Gary's question also. One need not be a chamber to be haunted. One need not be a house. The brain has corridors surpassing material place. Far safer of a midnight meeting, external ghost, than the interior confronting that cooler host. Far safer through an abbey gallop, the stones a chase, than unarmed oneself encounter in a lonesome place. Ourself behind ourself concealed should startle most. Assassin hid in our apartment be horror's least. The body borrows a revolver and bolts the door, or looking a superior specter or more. So, you know, we think of the evil one is out there, especially the big evil one, which is Satan. But it's projection, because we're not noticing ourself behind ourself concealed. That's what would startle us more than a burglar coming to our house. We would be shocked to meet up with that other side of ourselves, what Gary brought up. So we have both and. Some people have so given themselves over to one side that we either fear or admire them, but most of us are somewhere in between.
What's the name of the poem?
One need not be a chamber. She doesn't have names, you just use the first line. I just wanted to read a sentence or two. I was on page 18 of our book, The Sacred Heart of the World. And that first paragraph, suffering and grief happen to all of us in the human family and in our own families. The betrayals, disappointments, and abandonments are wounds like those Jesus had. Are our hearts wounded because we're being punished? Suffering is actually richer in meaning than this. It's the necessary ingredient for growth and redemption. And on the next page, we can trust that we are designed for self-healing since we were destined to be wounded. Okay. Carol, you had a question?
It seems as if what you have been addressing up to this time,
yeah, that's it,
has been I really like the attitude of yes and acceptance, and there are times when I cannot do anything about a situation that is sad, evil. But how does that help motivate one to move to some kind of social action for what needs to be changed, for a strategic change mm-hmm. that needs to happen?
I'm glad you brought that up, because it would always be side by side. If you look at the prayer by Reinhold Niebuhr, Lutheran theologian, and it's the one used in Alcoholics Anonymous. So it's always going to be the courage to change the things we can change. That has to be side by side, again, the both and, with the serenity to accept the things we can't change. The yes is to both. I want to say yes to the courage that's in me that does what Carol just said, go to the social action place. And I want to say yes to the part of me that can let it be. So the serenity is the let it be, and the courage part is, what is my calling? We talked about that last time. Why do the innocent suffer? Turns into, yes, I'm doing something for the starving children. So that's the calling instead of the why. So let's just move on to the other question, which is, why do the innocent suffer? And of course, implicit in why do the innocent suffer is the old ego mafia view, which is the innocent should be protected and have good things happen to them, and the evil people should be punished and have bad things happen to them. So under this is the superstition that punishment goes to everyone who somehow offends or hurts us, and reward goes to those who haven't hurt us or have been kind to us. And secondly, this question of why the innocent suffer has behind it a kind of equation that many of us have carried around for so many decades, that pain is somehow your fault. It's a punishment because of some choice or missed choice that you're responsible for, and happiness is a reward. So when we break these equations and say pain is not punishment and happiness is not a reward, pain happens to anyone, happiness comes to anyone, and there's no force that's making sure that the bad are being punished and the good are being rewarded. In fact, the good could have a terribly difficult life, as you know, and the bad people could have a wonderful life with lots of good luck. So it's accepting, this is about accepting the given, that things are not set up in the court, judge, jury, court manner. If you're innocent, you will be exonerated, and if you are guilty, you will be punished. That is not how the world is set up. It doesn't have a rule like that. Anything can happen to anyone. So when you hold it in yourself that the guilty, the bad people should be punished, then you're maintaining this old superstitious view. It is not the view of Christ. It is not the view of spirituality. It is not the view that represents a mature entry onto the spiritual path, because that will be about loving kindness toward all. It'll be like the compassion we talked about in our first session, that your compassion is for everyone in pain, whether this pain is because they've been victimized or because they're a predator. This is why the Sacred Heart is the overall metaphor that we're using for our series, because it's open to all. It's not limited. So so our statement, His opened heart never ceases to blaze with love for everyone, for the guilty and the innocent. And this, the implication in why do the innocent suffer is that the innocent should not suffer and the guilty should suffer. You know, I saw a very, very interesting example of this about a week ago, and I just made the connection yesterday because I was watching this program about movies, Hollywood movies and censorship. And they brought up the Legion of Decency. I don't know if you remember that. And this was a Catholic group that just gained more and more power over the kinds of films that Hollywood could produce. And they showed the person who was in charge of it at the time, and they explained that one of his rules was, if a film was about a criminal or someone who did something wrong, by the end of the film, he or she would have to be punished. And they had an interesting example. They used the example of a film with Barbara Stanwyck. And in it, she's a very kind of freewheeling, sexually liberated woman. And, you know, they were just going to show how she made her way to the top of the ladder by having sex with various important people. And, you know, that was the film. But once the Legion of Decency, because they would watch all the films before they could be released, they had to change the ending so she would die. And I thought back and I thought, yeah, that was the case. The guilty party will always be paid in full by the end of the film. And when we were watching films made in that way, we were being brainwashed into the superstition that the guilty will be punished, therefore the innocent should not suffer. And that's where this question comes from. This is not new. The book of Jonah, most of us know the story about Jonah, you know, he was swallowed by a whale, so forth, but there's a little more to the story. God asks Jonah to go and preach the word to the people of Nineveh. But these people are Gentiles, not Jewish. He does not want to do this because the word should only be for the chosen people. So he tries to escape. He goes on a voyage. And of course, there's a storm at sea, and the sailors who are superstitious say, there must be a jinx on board. Jonah says, yes, I'm the jinx because I'm refusing God's calling, so throw me overboard. They throw him overboard, he's swallowed by the whale or Leviathan. And he spit out right at the city of Nineveh, which is where he was supposed to begin with. So, get this. He says to himself, well, they're not going to accept the message anyway, so what I'll do is I'll go out and I'll give the message, and then, when they don't accept it, God will send down lightning and storms and kill them all. This was his thought. But, to his surprise, they accepted his message completely. The king himself loved the message. They all repented. They wore sackcloth and ashes. They were sorry for their sins. This made Jonah very, very angry. So he went to God and said, I thought they would wind up being punished because they're pagans. And God, now I'm going to quote what God says in response. And this is Jonah 4:11. Should I not have concern for the great city of Nineveh, in which there are more than 120,000 people who can't tell their right hand from the left? So I'm going to have compassion for them. So in this instance, God, instead of showing God as the punitive one, shows him as the immensely compassionate one and contrasts him to Jonah. Everybody get it? So the story is, of course, trying to show us that It isn't about trying to make sure they get theirs. When you're really spiritually oriented, there's no more they'll get theirs, or what goes around comes around. It's been changed to may they get the message, may they be enlightened, not may they get theirs. And what goes around comes around changes to may what goes around come around in a way that's transformative. This is what you would want if you were having in yourself the same heart that was in Jesus. Okay, questions about this part? Ginny, you want to come up?
Well, this morning I heard the dedication of the museum for 9/11. And what struck me so much is they had the people speak that were related to the victims. What I was really struck by was that they all seemed to be headed for compassion and loving and all of that that was manifested. But the word terrorist was still there. And I was hoping that, I think President Obama did say that we hopefully we make something positive come out of this. But in the end, it still came that it was us, and that it had not seen the pain that it had come from the whole incident of the people that did it. Mm. And it ended up with God bless us and God bless America. And I thought, you know, I'm waiting for the time when we say just what you did, that to see the pain of the people that are perpetuating this, and then to be able to say without being a betrayed patriot, a betraying patriot, God bless the whole world and yes. all of creation.
Yeah. Thank you, Jenny. And that would be the ultimate goal. When one had a truly spiritual sense, it's always it's never about punishment. It's always about finding a way to be compassionate. I mean, it reminds me of I don't know if you remember this. It's a couple of years ago, maybe. Some group of fundamentalist Christians were coming to the funerals of Iraqi soldiers, and they were gathering outside the church and saying terrible things, saying, "You wasted your life. This is a complete waste of time." Do you remember this? And the interesting thing to me about it was I remember hearing this on the radio, and they interviewed one of these people in the group. And they said, I guess you were hoping that people would become anti-war and that people would, you know, change. You know what the person said? He said, "No, we don't want people to change and repent. We want them to be punished for what they've done." I thought, this is the very opposite of the gospel says repent and be saved. He actually said that. He said, "No, we don't want them to. We don't want people to change for the better. We want them to be punished." I thought, where does an idea like this come from? Yes. Good example of ignorance and hate. Michael.
When I read this chapter, on the top of page 20 was a statement that really jumped out at me and stuck with me. And I think you capture in that exactly what you're talking about when you say spiritually aware adults have noticed, and I love that verb, noticed, have noticed that suffering is not a punishment. And happiness is not a reward.
Yes, thank you. and I'll go on. Our question is not why is there suffering, but how can we relieve this here and now suffering in ourselves and in others? And the last part is a quote from the Gospel of St. Luke. What then shall I do? That's the only question that will remain. What then shall I do?
Two things. One is, can you speak, is this appropriate to speak to the inner part of ourselves, the inner life of ourselves, like St. Teresa did in The Inner Castle, about boundaries and projections and the importance of, yes, we can love people, but we have to make choices, or we'd be codependent to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, I may be alone in this, but I do think people have bad behavior. And I think there's a soul, and I think there's bad behavior. So maybe, do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I think
yes.
People that crashed into the had bad behavior.
Yeah.
And it's not worth me saying right now what I can't just say that's okay. It's not okay.
No, you're bringing up a good point, which is we're always going to speak up. That's called speaking truth to power. We're never going to be scared off. We're going to stand up and say something, but we're going to try to do it in a way that tries to win someone over rather than tries to scold, judge, or punish someone. Best example, of course, is speak the way Columbo does. You remember him? He has a way of talking where he certainly gets the point across. But he says things in a way that, you know, puts people at their ease. That would be the style. Now, I want to share this other part of the topic, which isn't in the book, but it occurred to me, looking at the Beatitudes. The Beatitudes are a list of statements that Christ presented to his disciples. So I'm going to give you some examples. And this is from Luke chapter 6, starting verse 20. Blessed are you poor, and the word used for poor means destitute, because in the Jerusalem at the time they had ranking, as we talked about last time. So the poor people were like Mary and Joseph. They were poor. But the destitute had nothing at all. And it says here, blessed are the destitute, for theirs is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who are hungry, for you shall be filled. Blessed are you who weep and grieve, you shall smile. Blessed are you when people hate you, when they reject you, when they reproach you for my sake. And St. Matthew adds, rejoice and be glad, because then your reward is great in heaven. For this is how they persecuted the prophets before you. Now, what comes up from the Beatitudes is something very, very interesting. Because destitution, hunger, being persecuted, being hated, hurt, these are all things that we consider forms of evil, things that are not appealing, things that are very bad, things that represent injustice. But look what he's saying. He's saying these are the very things that give you the full connection to the heart of God. That you who are at the mercy of all this evil, you're the ones who will inherit the kingdom. What is the kingdom? The world of light that is ruled by justice, peace, and love. And he's saying the path to it is through the evils that come to us. Imagine how radical this is. That's what occurred to me. I said to myself, this is quite a proposal, because he's taking the things that we consider examples of economic injustice, destitution, hunger, so forth, and he's saying this is actually the path, the way of the cross, path of contradiction, that leads to the maturation of our spiritual destiny. So I'm just bringing this in because I thought we definitely want to make note of this. That's all we can do, just make note of it. We can't say, oh, okay, then I'll go ahead and be poor and I'll go ahead and be hungry. It isn't like that. But there's something about this that's enormously challenging. And I haven't myself yet worked with it enough to say a lot about it. But I certainly have noticed it. And I find it enormously fascinating that the spiritual tradition that we come from is one that says that all the things that we're ultimately against also happen to be the things that bring us closer to God. And it's hard to... Jackie, do you want to come up and make a comment? It's hard to see exactly how it works, but it's just a wonderful thing to contemplate.
I've puzzled over that too, and I've come to the conclusion that it does not automatically make you blessed by God to be destitute, to mourn, because some people go in the opposite direction. But what it actually does, I'm old enough to have been through a lot of these things, not destitution luckily, but a lot of the grievances of life, what it does is simply open the doors. Then you have the choice whether to walk through or not. But it's wider open when your guard is down, as it is when you're miserable. You know what they say, there's no place to go but up. When you're really, really down, a door will open and you have the choice. You can walk through it or you can say, oh, the heck with it. But it's there nevertheless. So he doesn't want us to fall into a state of complete feeling abandoned simply because terrible things have happened to us. He's saying, look, these are your opportunities.
Yes.
Evil as they may seem at the time, this can bring you closer to the kingdom of heaven than you were when everything was going right.
Exactly. And it's also a wonderful reversal, because remember last time we talked about the ranking that the ego loves to engage in? He has reversed the ranks, because he says the poor will inherit the kingdom of riches, spiritual riches, of course, but the ego's view is the poor will have less and less. He's saying the poor will have more. So he reverses the values of the world of greed, hate, and ignorance. This is the answer to the question, why do the innocent suffer, when you really look carefully? The question fades away and you start to get it, that there's a parallel universe in spirituality that has reversed the ego style. Yeah.
I'm not sure if this doesn't answer the question, but it's come up for me. I just moved up here and I lived in Los Angeles, and my volunteer was being a chaplain in the women's jail. And somehow or another, that experience over 3 years, I became aware that these women who were in jail for all of the that we're talking about and certainly put down by society were actually the most grace-filled people I have ever met. And so I guess, on the other hand, I don't know, but they filled my life to full that I had never had before. So In fact, I would say to them that they've humbled me, and I was there to exalt them.
Mm.
It was so.
How beautiful. That says it all, and that gives us a perfect example of what I just brought up. Well, we just have a minute or two left, so let's have one last question, and then I'd like to end with another poem.
I just want to add to it that I don't think it's a matter of whether you're destitute economically. It's destitute spiritually. And it's not a matter of whether you're hungry, but rather whether you're hungering and thirsting for truth and meaning in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And you won't do those things unless... Most people won't, unless there's great pain, so that your own created solutions and sense of control has been obliterated, and you realize that you don't have control, and that the things that you've been doing simply aren't working. And then you're poor in spirit, and then you're open. Yeah.
It's a very good way of putting it. Thank you. And since St. Matthew's version, he does say poor in spirit. So thank you, Jan. Well, I'd like to end with this poem by Wallace Stevens, in which he shows that we bring these puzzling questions to nature. So we haven't said much about that. So I thought this poem will kind of bring us there. The poet is from Connecticut, and I guess one word in it that you might not know is hepatica. Hepatica is a plant or a weed that grows there, in the shape of a liver, hence its name. And when you hear the poem, you will certainly catch on to the sense of being in New England. But notice how in the poem he brings the questions into nature and there is able to find an answer. It feels good as it is, without the giant, the thinker of the first idea. Perhaps the truth depends upon a walk around the lake, a composing as the body tires, a stop to see hepatica, a stop to watch a definition growing certain, and a weight within that certainty. Perhaps there are moments of inherent excellence, as when a cock crows on the left and all is well, incalculable balances at which a kind of Swiss perfection comes. Not balances that we achieve, but balances that happen as a man and a woman meet and love forthwith. Perhaps there are moments of awakening, extreme, fortuitous, personal, in which we more than awaken, sit on the edge of sleep as on an elevation, and behold the academies like structures in a mist. Thank you.